I'm Peter O'Dowd, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support your NPR station at donate.npr.org/now. Here and Now helps you make sense of the world right now, the impact of the pandemic on every aspect of our lives, the transition to the Biden administration, and how that will change Washington and America and your hometown, and all the stories from around the country, the local and regional news that resonates everywhere. So make a donation today, and that investment will come right back to you. It is more important than ever. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now let's get to the news.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. The FDA says there are more doses of the Pfizer-BioNTech coronavirus vaccine in vials sent out than previously thought. That could boost supplies by 40%. Today, an advisory agency is meeting to decide whether to recommend Moderna's vaccine for emergency authorization use. The good news comes as the number of infections and deaths continue to rise at an alarming rate.
Mm-hmm. A third of the deaths in the country from COVID-19, more than 110,000 people, are those living in nursing homes and long-term care facilities. There are parents, grandparents, and community elders, many of whom who live in Florida. Nearly 40% of the state's coronavirus deaths were in nursing homes. But this week, some hope. Residents in the Sunshine State are among the first in the country to get the vaccine. And let's check in with Karen Barker-Robbins, Vice President of Clinical Services for Orchid Cove, which operates a number of nursing centers across Florida. Karen, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for allowing me to join.
Yes. This pandemic has wreaked so much havoc on this vulnerable population. I can only imagine how it feels to finally have some hope after months of devastating loss.
Oh, absolutely. It has been a very fatiguing experience for not only our residents who have been isolated from their loved ones, and very trying for our employees as they try to work through all the requirements of being sure that we keep our frail elderly safe from the COVID virus.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the process. Only nursing homes and long-term care facilities in Broward and Pinellas counties are receiving doses right now. Governor Ron DeSantis prioritized these two counties because they're able to handle the cold storage requirements of this vaccine. How has the inoculation process gone so far?
I had the experience of firsthand knowledge of how the process is going yesterday, because we had one of the first facilities in the state of Florida to receive the vaccines. It went very smoothly. We had what's called a strike force team that consisted of four members. Two of them were from contractors from the Department of Health in Pinellas County, and then two of them were members of the National Guard. They warn you, or they give you information prior to them coming in and helping you give a checklist to get everything set up and get consents from your residents as well as your employees. And it went absolutely very smoothly, and it was a very good experience for both our staff and our residents. It was a very positive.
That's good to hear. We know that Florida received 21,000 initial doses of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, which will be distributed among the 112 long-term care facilities in those two counties. What kind of strategy is in place to ensure equitable distribution? And how has that been going so far?
Well, we were notified of the date of the strike force coming into our building. They provide us with information regarding the vaccines and consent forms, and they put it in our hands to be able to educate on the vaccine.
You mentioned the consent forms a couple of times. Inoculating some of these nursing home residents requires obtaining permission from family members. How high of a hurdle has that been?
It has not been difficult at all. It's, of course, a little bit logistically complicated because some of our residents are not able to give permission, so we need to go to families or responsible parties. And that's just a logistical thing where we just, you know, contact the families via phone or email for their consents. But in the facility that I was at yesterday for the inaugural vaccinations, we had a very, very good response. We had about 75 to 80% of our resident population accepting the vaccines.
What kind of sentiment are you hearing from residents themselves or even family members about taking the vaccine? Are there people who are refusing it?
There are some residents and responsible parties who did not consent. Some of them just wanted to have a little bit more time to see what the vaccine could produce or provide from a side effect perspective. But the majority of our residents or their responsible parties that made the decisions from them were actually very excited to be able to participate so that they feel that this will help get their lives back to normal.
Nursing homes and these long-term care facilities were the epicenter of the virus earlier this year. What is the situation like now?
We have definitely gone on a decline in our nursing homes. And of course, that's attributed to, you know, more increased knowledge about the virus as time has gone on. And of course, you know, adherence to the CDC guidelines. So we've pretty much just sort of stabilized in the long-term care arena.
You're probably feeling really hopeful now. It's been a hard few months.
It has been very difficult. It's just been very psychologically draining. So we're very excited to be able to see the light at the end of the tunnel with the fact that the vaccinations will be able to provide us to get back to more of a normal way of life.
Karen Barker Robbins is the Vice President of Clinical Service at Orchid Cove in Florida. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
10 states are suing Google. They allege that Google has abused its power and that it colluded with Facebook to dominate online advertising. But big tech companies are also going after each other. Facebook has launched a series of advertisements railing against Apple. For the latest, we're joined by NPR business correspondent Shannon Bond. Hello, Shannon.
Hi there.
First off, let's note that Google, Facebook, and Apple are among NPR's financial supporters. Explain the latest lawsuit. What does it claim Google's doing to dominate online advertising?
Right. Well, I think probably everybody knows that ads are a big business for Google. I mean, it made $135 billion almost from ads last year. But behind every ad that shows up on your smartphone or on your computer, you know, for the ad to sort of go from the advertiser to show up in front of you, there's this complicated chain of technology. And the attorneys general in this case are saying Google is the biggest player in every link in that chain. So here is how Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, who's leading this effort, here's how he put it.
If the free market were a baseball game, Google positioned itself as the pitcher, the batter, and the umpire.
So in this analogy, you know, that advertising is a game, Google is playing on both sides. It's helping publishers sell ad space, it's helping advertisers buy that space, and it's calling the shots. It's acting as the umpire. And the AGs say that Google, you know, is using that power to overcharge advertisers and box out its competitors. And there's also another allegation in this lawsuit that it treated one competitor differently, Facebook. It accuses Google of essentially colluding with Facebook. It says the two companies cut an illegal deal to manipulate the online ad market, which is a pretty explosive charge.
So what do the states want Google and Facebook to do about it? What do they say would repair the problem?
Well, this lawsuit just takes on Google, even though Facebook is mentioned in it. The states are asking for a jury trial. They want Google to pay damages. And they're also suggesting that it be forced to change its ways. Now, they didn't get into details here, but the lawsuit talks about structural relief, which are sort of changes that could involve selling off parts of its business or making it, you know, stop doing certain things. So that will remain to be seen by court. But, you know, they'll definitely push for, you know, for them to rein their behavior to be reined in.
And how about Facebook and Google? What are they saying in response?
Well, Google says these claims are meritless. It says it will defend itself in court. You know, it points to evidence of a competitive market. It says, you know, look, ad prices have fallen. The prices for these ad technology tools have declined. And so, you know, there's lots of competition out there. And Facebook declined to comment on this lawsuit.
Google and Facebook were already facing other antitrust lawsuits. Could you remind us what those are and how this legal action by these attorneys general fit in with them?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot. There's a sort of a scorecard we have to be keeping. These companies are under so much scrutiny right now. So back in October, the Justice Department sued Google over its search business. There's also another group of attorneys general that are investigating the search business, and a lawsuit on that is expected very soon. And just last week, the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, and more than 40 states accused Facebook of dominating its rivals in social media, buying them up or making it really hard for them to compete. So, you know, they are kind of getting scrutiny and pressure from all sides right now.
And really, the big tech companies are going after each other as well. Facebook is publishing a full-page ad in major newspapers today that claims Apple's new iPhone operating system would change the internet as we know it for the worse. What's this all about?
Right. So this is a fight over, you know, what would normally be fairly like arcane privacy settings on iPhones. So Apple is putting in this place this new policy that would essentially limit personalized ads that are based on user data. It would make it that apps would have to get users to consent to share their data. And Facebook says this would be really harmful, not just to itself. I mean, Facebook sells a lot of advertising, but to small businesses that use these kind of personalized ads to find, you know, the most likely customers. And so, you know, this is just kind of a challenge and a fight that has blown up. And it's really, you know, at the time when they're both under fire over anti-competitive practices, Apple is also under investigation. And it's been sued by some app developers for the grip it wields on its app store. And you know, this is kind of Facebook wading into that fight, seeing Apple as a really ripe target here.
NPR's Shannon Bond, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
We can always count on actor Forrest Whitaker to take on rich, complex roles, from Edward Garlick in Good Morning Vietnam to Zuri in Black Panther. But one talent we rarely get to see is Whitaker's musical chops, until now. The Academy Award winner stars in the Netflix musical Jingle Jangle, A Christmas Journey, as Jeronicus Jangle, a genius toy maker who rediscovers his love for the craft after his assistant steals his inventions and his family falls apart. Check out Whitaker's pipes.
I'm gonna make it work again. Try to fix every pot that's broken. I'm gonna make it work again. Every little hour that I spend is gonna be worth it in the end. If I just get it, I just get it to work again.
Jingle Jangle, A Christmas Journey was written and directed by David Talbert. It's available on Netflix. And Forrest Whitaker joins me now to talk about it. Welcome.
It's great to be here with you.
Yes, so Forrest, we know you for your dramatic performances, but you're a singer too. What drew you to this role?
Well, there's so many things that brought me to it. I think when I met with David, he had such a passion about the story, the director. And I, honestly, it was an opportunity to do a project that was really had a lot of depth and that was exploring falling down, you know, losing everything and then through recovering your family and yourself, being able to live again, to find joy again, to make people believe in joy again. And so those challenges and the fact that I got a chance to sing made it an amazing opportunity for me to get to do it.
Let's listen to one of your songs from Jingle Jangle. This is Over and Over.
Over and over and over again.
Oh, Forrest, I read that in college you studied music and performed in a chamber music group. Did those skills come back to you easily for this role?
They came back. At first, I was really scared. You know, I had studied singing and had been studying classical voice, I guess, a long time ago. It was like in college. So I wasn't sure that I would be able to do this part and play this character. And David was really sure of it. And when I'd be working on the songs, I would call him periodically and say, you know, this song is too high. I really can't do it. And he'd say, no, we need to do it that way. You can do this. And then slowly my joy just started to rise again more and more as I worked on the songs. But I started to even like say, you know, if you need me to do anything else, let me know, you know. And he trusted me. Like the song you just played over and over, I sang live on stage. What we did was, we started the scene and where we were supposed to cut and when the song begins, David just let it keep going and I just started to sing. And it's like two or three songs in the film that I sing live and that they orchestrated afterwards.
Tell me why, tell me what all this was for. My life should have meant so much more. Me who used to believe.
You mentioned how writer-director David Talbert pushed you. He believed in you. That's important for an actor, isn't it? Sometimes when you're not quite sure if you have the ability to do it and somebody else sees that in you.
Yeah, it definitely was, because you're following on the journey and sometimes you can't really see what's happening. And at times you doubt yourself. And when a filmmaker has, such great confidence in you. I mean, for David, he had expressed that it was really important for me. I was the first person that he cast in this project. And it was really important for him that I do this role so it could match the vision of what he wanted it to be. And he had that in his head. It's a quite fantastical, whimsical, and really wonderful movie. And he was able to see the whole of that and make me believe in it and what my contribution was going to be in regards to creating a new figure for these types of films.
Mm-hmm. This character, Jeronicus Jangle, is a brilliant toy maker, as we mentioned, who can no longer invent after his heart is broken. His assistant steals his work and his beloved wife dies. And he begins to rediscover his love for invention when his granddaughter comes to visit, and she loves to invent too. And in this scene we're going to play, he tells her what a gift that is. Let's listen.
A child with an imagination always belongs. Never be afraid when people can't see what you see. Only be afraid if you no longer see it.
That's such a powerful message to kids, to not be afraid of their imagination. How important is it? I'm thinking especially in this time, that message for kids who are watching this while stuck at home during this pandemic.
You have to know that you will be able to move back into the world of life that you want, to believe in magic and truth and joy, and to allow yourself to feel it and to know that tomorrow you'll be able to feel it in a different way. And for you, maybe an even better way. This movie comes at a time when people are looking so desperately to get through all the struggles and the pains of course, the pandemic and then the social unrest and move forward with their lives in some way and to try to turn it into a positive. Kids need to be able to know and believe that's possible. We all do actually need to know and understand that the miraculous can happen and it can happen in your life again. And that we're right now rebuilding ourselves to it. Each day is a movement towards us being able to find that joy again and freedom again and our lives back again in the way that we want to play them. So I was really, really blessed to be able to be in a project like this that would make that statement.
You know, I'm thinking about something I read about why you got into acting. And one thing I've heard you say in the past was that you wanted to explore the human condition through acting. And music is another way. It's like another way for us to express ourselves. I just was really struck when you said, as you started to sing, the more and more you sang, the joy kind of rose up inside of you. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit more about that. I mean, that's something that we just take for granted when it comes to what music can communicate for us.
It brings us to another level in the sense of ourselves and our feelings, because music is like vibration. And I think, and we can feel those things, the shaking of our heart, from listening to different songs and we mark our lives at times by some of the music that we've even felt, the experiences that interlace with it, that particular vibration, when we hear it again, that song again, we experience and re-experience what we've seen before. And music has that power to really delve deeply into the soul and allow us to see ourselves in our purest sense.
You know, you're among the league of actors that seem to choose roles that align so deeply with who you are. And you've got quite a few projects coming up, including Respect, about Aretha Franklin, which I and so many others can't wait for. In that movie, you play C.L. Franklin. What can we expect from that character?
You're going to see in this film like the deepness of the relationship between him and his daughter Aretha, about the push that he had on her, the sort of Bengali-like relationship that was occurring between them. You'll see someone who has like a deep spirit who's connected with the civil rights movement, with his daughter, to try to move forward the black race. And you'll see someone who like ultimately releases his hold and like celebrates the power of his daughter's talent.
Hmm. Jingle Jangle writer-director David Talbert has talked about the need to tell stories that represent the way the world looks, that his son could watch. How important is that for you to have a story like this during the holidays?
I think it's important for people of all cultures and for people of color, black people and brown and whatever, to be able to see themselves on the screen and be part of this tapestry that makes humanity, you know, which is all of us together. And I think if you look at the story, the themes inside of the story are completely universal. And I think it's important for us to let diversity engage us and allow us to see the fullness of ourselves. And it's going to make some little kids proud of who they are and other little kids just joyous in the experience.
As you said, this film really teaches us, and the lesson for you specifically is that you can reawaken the joy inside of you. What do you want people to ultimately take away from this film?
To know that it's possible for you to reclaim joy. To know that with time, with patience, because we see Jeronica Shangle spending almost a lifetime with loss, but then at some point, you know, a window's opened, and then the window is like part of a door that opens out to something very beautiful. And if we continue to strive and continue to move, each step we take is a step forward. And I think that the new steps are going to come. It's going to give people joy.
What a message right now. We really need it, don't we?
I think so, yeah. I really do.
Forrest Whitaker, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Jingle Jangle, A Christmas Journey, is available on Netflix.
Support for this podcast comes from the Boston Foundation. A resilient city and region relies on the Boston Foundation to bring people together to solve Greater Boston's most serious problems, from the hardships of COVID to the fight for racial equity and other important issues that affect the lives of everyone in our community. Learn how you can help build a Greater Boston that works for everyone by partnering with the Boston Foundation at tbf.org/partner.
A major winter storm that began in the mid-Atlantic states yesterday dumped a foot of snow and more today in central Pennsylvania, New York, and southern New England. And even though students and teachers have gotten used to remote learning from home, some school districts have decided to call today a snow day. Cheryl Stanton, superintendent of the Mohawk Trail and Hallamont Regional School District in northwestern Massachusetts, made the announcement by song last night on social media.
Tomorrow is gonna be a snow day, so you can stay in bed, cover up your head, maybe read a book, maybe even cook. All I ask is that you find a way to help and be kind. Pick up a shovel. Tomorrow is gonna be a snow day.
Superintendent Cheryl Stanton joins us now. And that was wonderful, Cheryl. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Schools in your district are fully remote right now, but you still decided that today should be a snow day for teachers and students. Why?
There's really a couple of reasons. We still have several families that come into our school buildings to use our remote internet hubs. Some of those students transport in with their families and some take our buses. So with transportation being dangerous right now in the storm, we did decide to do a full snow day for our students. The other piece, too, is that we have several staff members that because of limited broadband access at their homes, they do also come in to teach from our school buildings. So, again, traveling during this time is really dangerous. So we did call that traditional old-fashioned snow day. And then the other piece is that, you know, we are hopeful that we will be able to return to in-person learning for all of our students. And these snow days are days that we hope we can use at the end of the year to really celebrate the work that's happened this year with our students, all of the resiliency that they have shown, and really use these days at the end where we can be in person.
Mm. How much snow do you all have where you are right now?
Well, that's an interesting question. It depends on what town in the district you ask. At our southernmost town, Plainfield, I think they're at about a foot. Where I live in Coleraine, we are at about 2 feet up here.
2 feet of snow. You include some suggestions in your song for what kids should be doing today. But what do you hope kids do on this snow day?
You know, my generation, we all remember that magic of a snow day. I think we all remember going outside and just, you know, playing, building snowmen, building snow forts, coming inside, having hot chocolate, really hunkering down with a good book. I think just taking a pause and really listening to the quiet of the snow and settling into, you know, a softer day so that we're really ready to come back to remote learning tomorrow.
Yeah, you know, I'm sure a lot of kids are happy to be outside today. That it's an exciting proposition to see all of that snow. Superintendent Staton, thank you so much for this. And I really wish you all the best, not only on this snow day, but for the rest of the school year.
Thank you so much.
Cheryl Staton is the superintendent of the Mohawk Trail and Hallamont Regional School District in northwestern Massachusetts, where today is a snow day.
A demagogue is defined as a political leader who gains support by appealing to people's prejudices instead of by using rational arguments. Author Larry Tye says at the core, a demagogue is a bully. For his new book, Tye has profiled a poster boy for 20th century demagoguery, Joseph McCarthy. The Republican senator from Wisconsin became known in the 1950s for whipping up fear with unfounded claims that everywhere from Washington to Hollywood had been infiltrated by communist spies. It was known as the Red Scare. Larry Tye's book is called Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy. He says he started writing the book when Donald Trump had just been elected. Tye would scour the secret documents he'd been given about McCarthy. Then he'd pick up a news article about President Trump, and it was easy to get the two men confused.
Whether it was the way that demagogues point fingers and create scapegoats, and in Joe McCarthy's case, the obvious scapegoats were alleged communists behind every pillar in the U.S. State Department, and in Donald Trump's case, the scapegoats were the rapacious immigrants pouring across our border. Whether it was the way each of them aimed a wrecking ball at any assailant, or the way that when the news was bad, they blamed the newsmen and the newswomen.
Take us to the Lincoln Day dinner that Joe McCarthy spoke at. And this is when he basically made that calculation that I could give a speech here that will be boring, or I could give a speech that would make headlines and keep me in the public eye. Take us there.
It was February of 1950, and the Lincoln Day dinner is a day that Republicans all across America get together to celebrate their patron saint, Abe Lincoln. And if you're a prominent U.S. senator, you get invited to places like Boston and New York or Chicago. If you were Joe McCarthy in 1950, you got invited to what his staff called Wheeling, West by God, Virginia. He shows up there that night with two speeches in his briefcase. One is on a topic he actually knew something about. It was a snoozer of a speech on national housing policy. And if he had pulled that speech from his briefcase that night, Lisa, 70 years later, you and I wouldn't be here talking about Joe McCarthy. But instead, he reached deeper into his briefcase. He pulled out a speech where he charged that there were 205 communist spies in our State Department, that President Truman should have known about them and that they were why we were living in mortal fear of the Soviet Union. What he was holding in his hand that night may have been his grocery list. It may have been some recycling of ancient charges, but it sure as heck wasn't a list of 205 spies in the State Department because they didn't exist. But it worked.
So there never was such a list.
There were never such a list.
205 spies that we know.
There were never that many spies. All the 24-carat spies had been exposed long before. And it was said over the years in a joking way, but I think it was true, that Joe McCarthy could have been dropped into the middle of Red Square on May Day and not known how to pick out a communist. And he proved that true over the next 4.5 years when he would invent charges, target people who were at most guilty of having had some leftist fling, maybe in college, but he didn't uncover any serious spies. He did, however, make his name synonymous with reckless accusation and political double dealing to the point where 70 years later, Joe McCarthy may be dead, but McCarthyism is alive and well.
What kind of an impact did those accusations have on politicians, on those he was accusing, on those who had to come before his committee and in some cases be humiliated, lose their jobs?
Joe McCarthy always used to say, name one person whose life I made worse. Well, I found that there were hundreds of people whose careers were ruined. There were millions of people who were silenced and still are to this day for fear that if they say something that seems too liberal, they'll have fingers pointed at them, accusing them of being a socialist and a communist. But most disturbing to me were the dozen people who I could point to, including two U.S. senators, who actually took their own lives because of what they told us in their letters that they left behind, or what their relatives told us, were absolutely a direct connection to Joe McCarthy targeting them. The targeting was serious enough, the devastation was serious enough, that they committed suicide.
We have seen, in some cases, Donald Trump at press conferences make accusations that he cannot back up and talk about rumors, things that he has heard that sound like the equivalent of Joe McCarthy holding in his hand these papers that supposedly had the names of spies in the American State Department. Do you think Donald Trump has had a similar effect on those people who he has accused and in some cases bullied in public?
So I think Donald Trump has had a devastating effect on a lot of people that he bullied, from people in Congress to people throughout the federal bureaucracy to people throughout the country. And I think we will be taking the same kind of body count with Donald Trump that we did with Joe McCarthy.
How did Joe McCarthy eventually lose power and basically lose his life, in part because he was so shunned?
So it was in the most famous set of congressional hearings ever held, the so-called Army McCarthy hearings, where Joe McCarthy took on an enemy that was too big to bully, the U.S. Army. And over the course of those months-long hearings, the American public got to see that this guy who they thought was their champion, in fact, looked more like the town rowdy. And there was a famous lawyer from Boston named Joe Welch, who in the middle of those hearings stood up and said, "Senator, have you no sense of decency?" And I think what was compelling about what Welch said was that all of America wanted to ask the same question by that point. McCarthy starts out the hearings with a 50% popularity rating. By the end of the hearings, his numbers are down to 34%. And once he lost public support, the U.S. Senate developed the backbone to censure him. They did that in December of 1954, and from then until his death in 1957, Joe McCarthy essentially drank himself to his grave.
But when we look at the results of the November election, Donald Trump has not been abandoned as Joe McCarthy was. He still has a very enthusiastic base. He got over 74 million votes. That's 47% of the votes. So even if you see him as a bully and as a demagogue, he's retaining a lot of his cachet.
So I'm an optimist, and I look at the fact that even though he got all of those votes, Joe Biden got a lot more votes, and that even though Donald Trump will still have a megaphone, it won't be the megaphone of the White House.
In the Joe McCarthy era, liberals were afraid to speak their minds because they were afraid of being accused of being a socialist or a communist, the worst thing you could be accused of then. So they didn't dare speak out, many of them. Republicans have been accused of the same thing now with Donald Trump. Even when they disagree with his politics, they're afraid of being named in a rant or a tweet from the president or called a socialist. What did you learn about how those liberals in the McCarthy era felt after he was out that may be instructive to how conservatives could potentially feel in the coming years?
I think that we have to look at who enables a demagogue like that to rise to power. And it's partly the public that elects them, but it is also, in the case of Donald Trump, all the people in the Senate and throughout the government that understood the absurdity of some of his charges, but never stood up for fear of his political wrecking ball that he would aim at them. And exactly that same way back in Joe McCarthy's days, his fellow senators only stood up at the end when McCarthy's popularity had taken a deep dive. And even President Eisenhower, the wartime hero commander-in-chief, stood up to McCarthy much too late. Eisenhower was McCarthy's enabler and chief. But I think the really good news is that while it took Joe McCarthy's death to end McCarthy's political career, it took Huey Long being assassinated and George Wallace being struck by a bullet that made his presidential campaign come to an end. In the Donald Trump era, it was the voters who tossed out the bully. And I think I have ultimate faith in the American public, and they lived up to my faith in this last election.
Larry Tighe is the author of the book Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy. Nice to speak with you, Larry. Thank you.
Great to speak with you, Lisa Mullins.
Finally, that's the word many are using for the latest step from Major League Baseball to elevate the Negro Leagues to Major League status. It wasn't until 1947 that the league allowed Jackie Robinson to play. And before that, the Negro Leagues flourished with some of baseball's most iconic players like Robinson and Willie Mays. Mike Pesca is here and now, sports analyst, and joins us to talk about this. And he hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. And Mike, why did it take so long?
Hello. Well, in 1969, there was a committee to answer the question, which other leagues should we count as official statistics? And they included leagues like the Federal League and some other leagues that, you know, some of them died out in the 1910s. But of course, at that time, Major League Baseball had only been integrated for a little over two decades. And the powers that be then simply did not regard, and this is an incorrect assumption, simply did not regard the Negro Leagues as on a par with Major League Baseball. But since then, there's been a huge movement in the stats community and among historians and just among people who love great players like Hank Aaron and Willie Mays to correct that wrong.
Yeah, it's hard to separate those dynamic players to elevate them to this level because they were so dynamic. There are no Negro League players. There are Negro League players in the Baseball Hall of Fame already, I should say. But what does it actually mean that the Negro Leagues are now equal to the major leagues?
Well, one thing is the record books. So statistics accumulated in the Negro Leagues through a period between 1920 and 1948, when there was integration and the last Negro League World Series was played, those will count in the official record books. It'll change some records slightly. For instance, Willie Mays did play a few games in the Negro Leagues, and we don't know how many hits he had, but we are sure that he had at least 17, so those will add to his totals. On the other hand, there are some great players where their feats are essentially the thing of lore and legend. So the great Josh Gibson, you know, his Hall of Fame plaque says he hit about or almost 800 home runs. We just don't know. So he's not going to jump ahead of Barry Bonds on the official chart. But when we can, and when, and they're still doing research on this, when they can ascertain and confirm statistics, those will be added to the record books.
Hmm. There are only a handful of men who played in the Negro League still alive. One of them is 96-year-old Bill Greason. He lives in Birmingham, Alabama, and he played for the Birmingham Black Barons. Greason spoke with NPR's Tom Goldman. Let's listen.
We were together. We had good attendances at the ball games, and we tried to help each other.
Greason also said that he and other Negro players knew they were good enough to play in the major leagues.
Oh, sure. I did. I had what was necessary to be a good pitcher, and I had the stuff to go with it.
You know, that's really hard to hear. I mean, he had the stuff to be a major league pitcher, but he couldn't do that because of racism.
That's right. And it's not just his perception or assertion that those players were just as good. They would play in barnstorming games and to make money on the side. White players would play Negro League players, and the Negro League teams were good. They would often beat the White or the National League or American League teams. And then, of course, you had when finally integration happened, all these great Negro League players came over, and they were some of the best players in baseball. It's not a question that they were absolutely as good. At least now we're looking at the statistics. And since baseball is a game that so values statistics and so values history, you know, it's a great thing because maybe the next time on TV and during opening day, instead of this, the fact Bob Feller is the only pitcher to have a no-hitter on opening day, now it'll say Bob Feller and Leon Day, Negro League pitchers, are the only ones to have a no-hitter on opening day.
You know, the broader context of all of this is really interesting in this moment that we're in now. Just this week, Cleveland's baseball team announced it will be dropping Indians as its nickname. Native American groups have been calling on this for decades. And then the last few years, athletes have reemerged as activists. I mean, this year specifically after the deaths of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and others. There's always a long way to go, but maybe the sports world is headed in the right direction.
You know, the way I look at it, there was a time, and it was epitomized by Michael Jordan supposedly saying, he said something like this, that Republicans buy sneakers too. And the meaning was nothing about partisanship, but the idea was sports necessarily had to think about marketing and appeal to everyone and not get into activism. But, you know, that was really the exception if you look at the history of sports. And there's always been activism within sports. And when you have, because so many of our sports leagues are majority or disproportionately, let's say, African-American or minority, when you have more and more powerful people with greater voices, so they're getting paid more money fairly, and now you have social media amplifying their voices, I think it was inevitable that the sentiments of those players were going to get out there. And so just as sports is a reflection of society, we're seeing players making their feelings known. It's inevitable, and it probably is a positive thing, I would say.
Absolutely. Mike Pesca is Here and Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, thank you for this conversation.
You're welcome.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now.